Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to episode 668 with my guest, Leslie Winnick. I am Paul Gilmartin. This is the Mental Illness Happy Hour. It's a place for honesty about all the battles in our heads, from medically diagnosed conditions, past traumas, and sexual dysfunction to everyday compulsive negative thinking. This show's not meant to be a substitute for professional mental counseling. I'm not a therapist. Don't think of it as a doctor's office or a therapist's office. Think of it as the waiting room outside where people awkwardly stare at each other and feel like they're the weirdest person in the room. The website for this show is mentalpod.com. MentalPod, also the social media handles you can follow us at. And we are at 792 paid monthly Patreon donors, and our goal is to get to 1,500 so that the podcast can break even. We really, really need some financial help, as I've mentioned on the past couple of episodes. I made the decision to walk away from my sponsorship with BetterHelp. They accounted for over half of my income, but for ethical reasons, not for the quality of their therapy, but for questions and issues that I had with their business practices, I made the decision to walk away from that. So if you hear ads that are still in episodes for BetterHelp, I no longer endorse them. And I will say that if you are currently a client receiving therapy from BetterHelp and it's helping you, please stay with it. You getting the help is the most important thing. This is from the Ask Paul Anything survey, and this is filled out by a woman who calls herself C. And she had written in before saying that the setting on the struggle in a sentence survey won't let her go back and take it a second time. And then she wrote in and said, sorry, it's the voice in my head survey. And so I went and I changed that. And all the surveys should allow you to take them a second time if you want to fill those out. And if for some reason they don't, let me know. And by the way, all of the surveys, we do not gather any personal information about you, i.e. email address or IP address, because I want people to feel free to be totally, totally honest. This is from the Love Survey filled out by Kenny. And they write, I love when I go to make a smoothie and it's the perfect consistency, not too runny or too thick. It's just perfect. That's a great one. Can't even remember the last time I had a smoothie. This is from the Struggle in a Sentence survey filled out by a woman who calls herself Irish Redhead. And about her anxiety, she writes, my panic disorder feels like all my skin is falling off and everyone is looking at a raw red body. Whoo! Whoo! That's intense. Is your raw skin the consistency of a perfect smoothie? Because if it is, I think maybe you need to look at the sunny side. This is from the Ask Paul Anything survey, and this is filled out by Wildflower. And she asks, what type of thinker are you? Visual thinker, kinesthetic or pattern thinker, auditory or verbal thinker, or a combination of any of these? I think I might be a visual thinker. And the subcategory of that is doom / grandiosity thinker, because I picture things that are usually in very black and white terms. But I also think verbally, a lot of times I will have like a word stuck in my brain, almost like it can't be filed away, whether it's somebody's last name that's kind of odd, or a word that you don't hear often in the English language. And I will find myself throughout the day kind of just thinking of that word in my mind, or it'll pop into my mind. And there, I don't know, there's something soothing about it. It's kind of weird. Any comments to make the podcast better? Can you interview some neurodivergent people, specifically dyscalculia? And that is people who have a learning disability around math and numbers. I might be misrepresenting that. This is from the body shame survey filled out by a guy who calls himself unofficially Italian. I think we've read a survey from him before. What do you like or dislike about your body? I dislike the size of my penis, thanks to society. I used to watch a lot of porn, and I understand that most men can develop self-consciousness when compared to a porn star. But I don't watch it anymore. It's been a few years. However, I'm surprised by social media and how it has continued this self-consciousness in me. Every time I scroll Instagram, I'm bombarded by videos, memes, and other posts suggesting that the only men that matter are the ones who are well endowed. Logically, I know how toxic social media is in general, but I still find myself getting sucked into the narrative. Yeah, I think it's a lot more common than, or maybe people know that it's common. You don't really hear men ever talk about it, though, about their insecurity. At least I don't. This is from the body shame survey filled out by a woman who calls herself, oh, this is her friend Wildflower again. What do you like or dislike about your body? And she writes, my mom constantly tells me I don't look good and am fat and dress like a slut. Other than that, your mom is very complimentary. When we were kids, she would always tell me my younger sister, who's 4 years younger, was better looking than me. I wasn't allowed to wear high heels till she could, or a bikini. My mom bought her bras when she was one enough, while I got her old hand-me-downs. I think that she meant to say when she was old enough, while I got old hand-me-downs. I've only just now realized it was her comments that contributed to me having body issues and an eating disorder. I am now over that, but she still continues to call me fat and ugly, and that I dress like a slut even though I am almost 40. I also compete in pinup pageants and have got awards, so she can't say I'm completely hideous, but she does. I hope, first of all, that fucking sucks. And I'm sorry that that is the mom that you were dealt. And I would encourage you to ask yourself if it's worth maintaining contact with your mom. I'm not saying cut contact with your mom. I don't know the full breadth of the relationship with her. But what she says to you is super, super fucked up and toxic. And just the thought, you know, one of the things that I like to do on the podcast, although I do often give people advice, I feel like the wheelhouse when I'm being a good host is throwing out questions for people to ask themselves. This is from the Love Survey filled out by our friend German Couch Potato. They write, I love reading a really good fan fiction and feeling all the feels. I love long, meaningful, and authentic talks at night when everyone is tired enough to get vulnerable. I love cactuses. And then in parentheses, is that the right plural? Question mark. It might be cacti. I'm not sure. I love the beach and the sea. I love to feel the warmth of the sun and the wind playing with my hair. I love the smell of freshly grinded coffee beans and the sound of the coffee machine. I love being childish with my friends. I love listening to music and coming up with stories while traveling. I love the feeling of a long summer skirt on my legs. I love the feeling of grass and sand under my feet. And I have to stop now. Those are awesome. Thank you. Danke schön. This is an awfulsome moment filled out by a woman who calls herself Anxiety Puddle. And she writes, I've recently fallen back into some anxious and obsessive patterns and have been having a really hard time. I have a history with psych meds and have always had a hard time using them responsibly when there are any addictive effects. Daily life was getting too hard, so I made an appointment with my primary care doctor and told her about my anxiety. She gave me a prescription for a whole boatload of benzos, which felt like hitting the mother load. I cannot lie. 3 weeks later, I found myself on the internet ordering a lockbox with a thing called Fortress Mode that allows you to lock away medication, junk food, your phone, whatever it may be. You can lock the box for up to 30 days with no way to access it other than contacting customer service. In parentheses, how embarrassing. But anyway, I had to read some reviews before buying, and they were too perfect. One user talked about how this particular lockbox was pretty sturdy, and others he'd bought in the past had been too easy to smash open with a hammer. Another one said this lockbox was great because you couldn't pop the top off with a screwdriver no matter how hard you tried. I told a friend about it, and she laughed her head off and said if one of her vices was inside, she would literally run the thing over if she had to. God, we really are all in it together. Thank you for sharing that. And I've got to really question the prescribing of benzos, unless it was for short term. I mean, prescribing benzos in the long term is a terrible, terrible decision. And I don't know. You might want to consider seeing a psychiatrist. There can be some primary care doctors that I'm sure, though well-intentioned, do not think about things in the long term the way a good psychiatrist might. So just throwing that out there, and the fact that you have an addictive relationship with them can be really problematic. And, you know, people can't die from a heroin withdrawal, but people can die from a benzo withdrawal. They are fucking serious. So, yeah, just throwing that out there. This is from the Struggle in a Sentence survey filled out by Chrissy. And she struggles with bipolar too. And she writes to the question, give us a snapshot from your life that highlights one of your issues or struggles. And she writes, I must stay in control or something horrible might happen if I don't brush my teeth after I put on deodorant, leave for work at exactly 7:21. Head voice won't stop talking. Am I the only one talking to herself? Must put on music so the thoughts quiet down. Holy shit, I'm losing my mind. Now, let's do this all over again tomorrow morning. Fuck my life. Man, being a slave to the compulsive actions. Whew, that is a prison. We are going to take a quick break. Let's see if we have an ad. This episode is sponsored by When Breath Becomes Air. When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi is the exquisitely observed memoir of an idealistic young neurosurgeon attempting to answer the question, what makes a life worth living as he deals with his own terminal cancer diagnosis. It's a stunning reminder to live while we are alive. A must-read for anyone in medicine, from a doctor-turned-patient. For healthcare workers, expand your view on patient care and the fragile beauty of our mortal lives through Kalanithi's unforgettable words. Some of the questions Kalanithi wrestles with in this book include, what makes life worth living in the face of death? What do you do when the future flattens out into a perpetual present? When the future is no longer a ladder towards your goals in life? What does it mean to have a child, to nurture a new life as another fades away? When Breath Becomes Air is a number one New York Times bestseller, Pulitzer Prize finalist, and named one of the best books of the year by the New York Times Book Review, People, NPR, The Washington Post, Slate, and more. When Breath Becomes Air is available wherever books are sold. Learn more at prh.com/breath.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
And then finally, this is from the Love Survey, and this is filled out by Christy, and she writes, I've been feeling down lately, but knowing that my two dogs are right now sleeping comfortably in my bed makes my heart feel warm. No worries in the world for them. How it should be for all dogs.
My consciousness might be disintegrated.
Heavy weighted blanket on my brain.
Symptomatically.
And I can't think straight.
Things present themselves for a reason.
And I can't see straight. I couldn't even drive.
The first movie that I remember watching with him.
Post-traumatic stress.
When I was like 5 years old was Pulp Fiction.
And Moral Injury.
I would act out the scenes.
Gonna go to hell.
Or with my Barbies.
The greatest source of our suffering.
Ordinary is where all the good stuff happens.
Is our unwillingness to experience and accept our emotions.
It is very hard to heal in dark isolation.
I developed compassion.
It is in connection and community where that happens.
The process was nearly unbearable. Like, I'm going to have to kill myself. We'll be right back after this.
I am here with Leslie Winnick. I want to thank you, first of all, for being a Patreon donor and a member of our weekly online hangout on Zoom.
The waiting room. Oh, it's so good.
The waiting room. The first Sunday that we did it, share what the moment that happened that kind of led to me saying, I think you'd be a great guest.
Yeah.
And what a great subject.
I think it started out about feeling invisible. Yeah. And I mean, I think this is a sort of a common thing with women of a certain age, and I'm certainly that age. I'm 65. And I've noticed it in the past recent, you know, few years. And I think the funny thing that happened is, I think you were going around asking people to tell their stories or some such thing. And then you didn't call on me. Maybe there were 9 or 10 of us. And I remember, you know, in my own soul thinking, oh my God, actually, I can swear, right?
Yeah.
It's all right.
Yeah.
I forgot. Oh my fucking God. Maybe I am invisible. What do I do? I don't want to be rude and I don't want to insert myself and So I said something, and then I was worried you would feel bad. So we got into that loop of, you know, no one should feel bad. So invisibility, I think for a lot of people is a thing. And for me, I have noticed it over the course of just the past few years, really. The first time was with, I have 3 adult daughters. They're amazing people. Hi, Kate. Hi, Em. Hi, Dot. And they, I was in a bar with Dot. We had been on a road trip. We were trying to get a drink, and I was at the bar, and I literally could not get the attention of the bartender. I thought, oh, this is weird. Oh, I'm invisible. And then I went back and I told her and expressed my frustration. She went up and essentially got immediate service, pretty much. So I developed a policy that if I love eating out, I love going out by myself. And I developed a policy that if someone ignored me or found me invisible, I would leave them like a nickel tip. And usually, I've been a waitress many years of my life. I am a great tipper. But I would leave a little tip and a little tiny note that said, hey, you really shouldn't ignore women of a certain age. You missed out on a fantastic tip. Do better next time. Your mother wouldn't want you to be this way. And, you know, I've maybe left that note literally twice.
Yeah.
But the whole idea of being invisible, I think it's a thing that I assume more women experience than men of a certain age, but I'm not sure.
I would think so. One of the things that I think it was in our Zoom hangout that one of our participants who is a trans woman, I'm sorry, a trans man, shared is that when they were presenting as male, or I'm sorry, as female,
yes,
people wouldn't be that interested in their opinion. And then when they transitioned to male, suddenly people wanted to know what they thought.
Oh, Paul, it is stunning. And I spent 25 years at working at Stanford. Lovely place, amazing place. I, you know, love the community there, love the work. But I was in just a couple of meetings where a woman would say something or I would say something, and I swear 10 minutes into the meeting, a man would then say that thing and it would be suddenly, oh, what an excellent point. Didn't happen much because it's a pretty good woke-ish, whatever the word is, place. But yeah, it happens.
I've heard that a lot. My ex-wife who worked in writing rooms would share that quite frequently. She would come home and say, you know, I pitched this idea, and 10 minutes later, one of the guys in the room would pitch it, and everybody like, oh, I love that.
And you feel like, am I crazy? Is this really happening? And then after a while, you get, you know, pissy enough or angry enough that then you get better at saying what the truth is. Like, hey, you know, actually, that was something I just brought up. And it's just...
So you act like a bitch.
I'm known as a bitch in the circles I travel in. No, that's my problem. I'm known as a person who's perhaps afraid of being a bitch.
I'm kidding, yes.
You don't have to tell me that.
So let's talk some more about the invisibility. And let's start with the thoughts that come up in your head when you're feeling that, the things that you think about yourself and think about the people who are ignoring you.
Yeah. Well, so here's the good news and bad news story. The bad news is that it feels sort of just unfair. And like, you know, I'm a person with a, I think, pretty interesting history and life experience. But here's the good news. I've learned since we originally talked about that, however many, you know, weeks ago, and since then, that the invisibility, sort of, you can turn it around. And so here are the advantages of being invisible. And I think my sisters and a lot of my friends will totally get this. It gives you a stunning amount of permission to just be who you want to be. Because another example of invisibility, I can walk down the street in San Francisco, love San Francisco, and I swear people don't really notice you. They don't really see you. Once I tripped and this guy comes running up and says, you know, ma'am, are you all right? I was like, well, there you go. He saw me do that. But there is a little bit of a sense of I'm just living my life here. A little bit invisible, but it gives you permission. So what does it give me permission to do? To do exactly what I want to do, including some crazy things. Usually I wear ridiculously sparkly things. I give out magic wands because there's a whole thing I believe about magic and spontaneity and wands and doing what you want to do in life. And it really does. Oh, it took me into hobby stuff. I've always wanted to be Ginger Rogers. Who doesn't? And I wanted to do ballroom.
And for our younger guests, she is one of the preeminent dancers. She was the dancing partner of Fred Astaire, who's considered, you know, one of the greatest dancers ever, and their movies in the what would have been the 50s?
Probably the 40s and 50s.
40s and 50s.
Just
they were
gorgeous.
It.
Yeah. They were it. And if you haven't ever seen one, kind of do yourself a favor, find someone or...
Very romantic.
So beautiful. Yeah. So I always wanted to be her, but at some point in my life, I had a career in raising kids and a single mom for a long time. So I didn't really have the chance. And then part of this invisibility, hey, why don't I live my life? I'm now doing ballroom dancing. I've been doing it for a few years, and I don't care how bad I look. I don't care that, you know, it took me forever to get to the, you know, whatever level I'm supposed to be at, newcomer, bronze, all the things. And I have a more grace maybe for my own life because I have felt, yeah. I mean, Paul, this is a little bit of a tangent. Here we go. It is very interesting and sometimes a little odd to think of myself as 65, heading towards the end of things. Mm-hmm. You know, sooner or later, my mom got sick with ovarian cancer when she was 75, died when she was 78. So, you know, 10 years, if I have 10 years before I get some horrible thing, it's like, well, fuck, 10 years is nothing. My dad lived longer.
And you have experienced a double mastectomy and a hysterectomy?
Yes. Well, technically, it was. I can barely say this word. Technically, it was an oophorectomy. Why did they name a thing such a silly thing?
Is that meaning?
It means
take
only
your ovaries.
Yeah, and your cervix. Yeah. So why it's not a hysterectomy? There are other things I guess I was lucky enough to keep. But, and that was an interesting experience. I think I was early 50s when I had that done. So as we were talking before the podcast, I immediately went into intense menopause. And the other thing I wanted to say before we start all this, my memory is so terrible. I mean, my big fear, my big fear is that we're going to be talking, I'm going to launch into some story that, you know, I've just told in the beginning. So give me a hand signal,
Well, you're with a kindred spirit on that one. It's embarrassing.
Oh, it's terrible. In the morning, I go to make coffee, and I'm like, you know, doing the first step. I put the coffee in, I get the water in, and then I sort of, I never do turn it on. Or I start folding laundry in the middle of that, and then I'm folding laundry. It feels like I suddenly have ADHD, which I don't think I have, but my ability to concentrate and see something through, ridiculous. Yeah. So
let's circle back to the thoughts and the feelings. You've shared kind of the positive things about invisibility and a kind of you feeling the freedom to be yourself, to not feel judged. Talk about the intense negative feelings that I'm assuming they're intense. Be it rage. You mentioned that it. I think you said that it feels unfair. Was that one?
Yeah. And I think when I relate it to the feelings of, you know, wait a minute. If I'm invisible, you, the person who's perhaps making me feel that way, and I know no one's making me feel anyway, but I feel that way in some conversation or something. It just seems so odd to me that I'm being discounted for my experience or for whatever it is that I kind of offer the world. And to be clear, I don't feel this way with any of the people in my life. Mm-hmm. My friends, my daughters, my husband, my sweetheart, all the things. My husband and sweetheart, by the way, are the same person. And so I don't feel it that much. But to get into like the way underneath of it all, as we've talked about, I think in our waiting room group, I've had five big, horrible episodes of depression that have two of which, maybe three. I count my depressions based on the cities I've lived in. Mm-hmm. So my first one, I was in London, studying abroad. It did not go well.
Did you cry with an accent when you were in London?
It's funny. My husband's an actor, and Mark P. Robinson, and God forbid you get rid of the P because there are plenty of those. And he right now is in a show where he has this gorgeous, very amazing British accent. I can't do any accents. I can do a little like Yiddish guilt. Barely. That's terrible. But what are we talking about?
You're talking to the wrong episodes.
Yes, the depressions.
Yes, yes.
So the first one was in London when I was on a study abroad program in junior year. I had to come back. I had to abandon it. I was suicidally depressed, actually. And, you know, trigger warnings abound here. I literally tried to kill myself in London when I was, how old are you when you were a junior in college? You're
20.
20-ish. Yeah. I had never really understood what depression was. I went into a profound dive, had no security around me, no family, no friends. I was at a program. You know, it was fine, but just they thought, ooh, that woman doesn't seem to eat much, doesn't seem to sleep much, which are all the things that leave when you get depressed. And thank God the director of the program said, you need to go home. And I got myself home, but not after one night of total despair, wandering around London, hoping I could step in front of a car and be gone. So that was the London depression. That led, you know, years later, quite a few years later, I ended up, I guess the next one was a really, really bad postpartum. So jump ahead a long time. And I was a married person. I have a husband. He is my ex-husband. I think husband is a good.
I've never heard that.
It's good. I put it in the Urban Dictionary. Mm-hmm. I've applied to get credit for that word. So my husband at the time, I had twin daughters, Kate and Em, who are now 37. I mean, how the fuck can they be 37 when I'm 44? And then I had a third daughter, my youngest daughter, Dot. And after she was born, I had a really bad postpartum situation. And postpartum is rough. A couple of our other group members have had it. Mm-hmm. And I feel so badly saying this. I had a little tiny baby. I had 5-year-old twins. I just thought I was useless and dark, and maybe everyone would just be better off without me. And this is the really scary thing, because I can barely believe it was me, even though it was totally me. It got so bad. We had a big Hawaiian woman, this amazing, we just called her Auntie, and Auntie would come, and she was both helping me, trying to have me eat something, because my big thing is I stop eating. If only I could do that now, but no. And I actually had a plan, like a big plan. I had a pink sweatshirt and sweatpants in the closet. And this is, you know, hard to admit to. And I had taken a knife, a kitchen knife, and I had hidden this in my closet in Hawaii, which is supposed to be, ironically, of course, paradise. And I would look when I would drive to work. I worked at Hawaii Public Radio for a couple of years. And I would drive to work pretty depressed over the Pali Highway. And I would, like, consider where would I go to do it, like off the Pali where no one would find me. I mean, I'm shaky when I'm saying that because it was very real. And thank God for medication. Thank God for therapy and therapists. Thank God for support systems. So that was the Hawaii depression. Should I keep going or?
I think we get a picture of that and some of the stuff that you've shared in our support group.
Yeah.
You paint such a vivid picture, and I gotta say, of the vignettes that people have painted of their depression, mm-hmm. yours were some of the most extreme in terms of debilitation.
Yeah.
And the fact that you're still here.
Oh yeah.
And you and you got through it. And I can't imagine what it's like when you are experiencing this moment of having a newborn and society tells you that you will be at your happiest, and
yes.
you feel not only despair, but I would imagine disconnected from them, as if they're, I don't know what, a thing?
Someone who you look at this little tiny, beautiful baby, blue eyes and everything, and you can't connect, and you know you are their nurturer. I mean, literally, I recall when I had Kate and Em, identical twins, for some reason, you know, I did not get depressed when I had them. There was no postpartum then. And I was like breastfeeding like a crazy woman. It was constant. And I did it for longer than I thought. It was like, wow, this is amazing. And Dot, when she was born, because I had such a terrible postpartum, you know, everything just, I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it because I just felt that terrible disconnect, as you said, and fear that I couldn't be the mom. I just couldn't do it. And, you know, although I have a love of my life that I've now been with for 25 years, and he is, you know, the person I was destined to be with, I was with Kate Amendot's dad at the time. And you know, he thankfully helped me get the care I needed, which included a stay at, I assume it still exists. There was an inpatient place. It was called Kahi Mohala. How can that name still be in my head? And I think I was there 5 days and, you know, life-saving.
And did you voluntarily go?
I spent one night at the Queen's Hospital in Hawaii, where actually Dot was born. It's such a beautiful name for a hospital, the Queen's Hospital.
What island?
Oahu, outside of Honolulu.
I love Oahu.
Oh, it's just...
Not as much as Kauai, but Oahu still...
Kauai's.
Oahu in the winter is the most fascinating, the size of the waves there. I've seen the Grand Canyon. Nothing compared to seeing Pipeline when it's 20 feet. Nothing.
It's scary even thinking about it. Yeah. Well, and we lived on the windward side of the island. We lived in Kailua, which is this wonderful little beach town. And that's when I worked at Hawaii Public Radio. So I would drive the thing over the ride over the poly.
I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
I'm sorry. Yep. So I ended up spending one night at the infamous 7th floor of the Queen's Hospital. My husband at the time, and I don't want to use his name because I don't know that he's, just want to keep his anonymity. He didn't know what to do. Because here I was not functional. I was like a deer in the headlights all the time. Just the whatever happens when your brain switches into that mode. And he took me there to the emergency room because he didn't know what else to do. And I spent one night at the 7th floor where I met, it was locked, 7th floor of I think the Queen's Hospital is probably the biggest hospital on Oahu. In downtown Honolulu, and it was a scary place.
Some of the things you saw or experienced?
Oh, my God. Well, there was one guy, he thought he had killed his dad. He had not. He was a huge man. I just remember him. He was like a mountain of a man. And we would be in groups together. He was very gentle. And we all understood he hadn't actually killed his dad. Mm-hmm. But he thought he had. And one day I went to do my laundry. I was there long enough to do laundry. And I find some amount of peace doing laundry. And I remember finding his clothes in the dryer. So I just folded his clothes. And there was this big yellow shirt I folded and big boxers and all this. And I just put it in a little stack and put a little note on his name with his name on it. And he found it and he came up to me. And he was very intense. And he just starts weeping. Out of gratitude. I mean, you know, to this day it gets me. He said, no one's ever done something so nice for me. I was like, oh, Jesus. And there were so many people there who were hurting, you know, and yet we were all hurting in such different ways. And there was another woman. Oh, this is crazy. She had lost her ability to bend at the joint. Any joint. Her hips, I guess, because she would sit at the couch. But her arms were out. Her legs were straight in front of her. And she talked a lot about conflict with her mom and her sister. I never totally understood what was going on with her. But it presented in her body. And we've talked about the somatic stuff, what mm-hmm. presents in your body. And she was locked in with that emotion. And it was maybe 6 or 7 months later when I was out, I literally saw her at a Nordstrom's, or no, it wasn't Nordstrom's, it was Hawaii, Liberty House or whatever mm-hmm. the thing was called. And I saw her at buying sunglasses. And I turned and I said, you know, Karen, I think we know each other. I'm Leslie from the group. And she hugs me and we're talking and she is 100% fine. And your body takes it in. I mean, for me, because when I'm depressed, I can't sleep, I can't eat. You know, I turn into this kind of skeletal person. I always only wore black. I mean, ironically, I still always only wear black pretty much. But then it wasn't really a choice. It was just, you know, put on the same pants, put on the same shirt, just do your best just to get out of bed. You know, if you can get out of bed, that was a big victory. You know, taking a shower was huge. And to this day, I was talking to Mark before I came here, and I've been healthy for a long time. My mental health has been really good. But I still check in with myself all the fucking time to make sure there's nothing on the edge of my what's going on. I think of it as I used to think of my depression as being locked in a dark closet with a mosquito. And when my depression was bad, the one mosquito that, you know, when you're mm-hmm. relatively healthy, you can get the one mosquito that's buzzing around in your ear. When you're really depressed, there are hundreds of them, and you are screwed.
And they're moving helpless. At the speed of light.
Yeah. And you just know, oh, my God. And so right now, I mean, thankfully, you know, I have a mosquito or two, mm-hmm. but they're all gettable, which is thank God for that.
So let's circle back to the thoughts and feelings that come up when you feel invisible.
Mm. I'm feeling a little bad right now because it's a little the invisibility theme. I sort of relate a little less to it on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. But let me think on it. I mean, probably because I found these little self-preservation things, like the, you know, not leaving someone a tip mm-hmm. or, and I'm so curious if it's more for women than for men.
Well, it's interesting that you say that because I was talking to a friend of mine on the phone the other day and we were just laughing about the fact that, you know, we're at that age that, you know, you never think about when you're young. We're 60. And
right.
And he was saying how he finds it funny how invisible he is around younger women. You know,
there you
used to check him out. But I don't think it affects him and probably men in general the way it affects because it has, much more to do with physicality. I think if he were to offer his opinion on something,
right.
it would be listened to more. And I think when somebody's discounting your intelligence, I would imagine that hits you even deeper than your physicality. When I was 23, I was hooking up with this woman who was 33 and I was kind of her boy toy. And I remember one time saying something and she wasn't even listening to me. And I remember I found it funny because I thought, buddy, this is karma. This is karma.
Okay. Yeah.
The number of times that you were just using a woman for sex. And, you know, I'm kind of amazed as I look back at that I was even aware of mm-hmm. that because that pattern of kind of objectifying and discounting would continue for years and years. Yeah. But I remember that feeling like, oh, I'm a thing.
Yeah.
I'm a thing.
And what changed in you when you stopped doing the objectifying women sort of routine.
The support group around intimacy and that bringing up the childhood sexual trauma and the mom stuff. And, you know, I got in touch with the feelings because I finally gave way to them instead of saying, well, you're just a terrible son, you're a baby, you're an exaggerator, you know, all that, all that stuff. And when I shared that in a support group, you know, which was half men, half women, and one time in particular, when I looked up and I was staring at the ground sharing this, and I was choking back tears, which I don't experience anymore when I talk about it. But this was a short window where all the emotions were coming up, and I looked up and there were women with tears rolling down their face. And that was the moment that I realized, oh, maybe I'm not an unlovable pig monster, you know, whatever you want to call it. And that's when something inside me kind of softened and let, I suppose one of the reasons that I objectified was that there was, a feeling of safety in someone being an object, because then I don't have to worry about them smothering me with their needs or whatever scenario I'd created in my head. But that was the beginning of something in me softening and learning platonic intimacy, and feeling I grew up without sisters, and I suddenly began, and I had always longed for that as a kid. So, you know, females were kind of this mysterious thing. And, you know, when your template for the opposite sex is when it's someone who's very complex. And there were many things about my mom that were great, but there were many things that were very confusing and hurtful. So to be able to understand that the goal is not to have my wall up around everybody, but to have it up around people who aren't safe and to lower it for people who've been proven to be safe. So that's when things change. But I want to go back to you and speaking of objectification, were there times in your life, especially when you were a younger woman, where you felt your body, your sexuality, whatever it may be in public, where it felt like, Jesus, I want to disappear because it feels invasive or gross?
Yes, and I think as I sort of got older and came into myself, and, you know, this sounds a bit hokey, I do, and I don't know what was the exact trigger of it. It was like claiming the power to not accept that as, you know, if someone would either view me in that way. Well, and here's the other piece of it. I mean, sometimes I found it lovely. You know, if I went to a bar and I got the attention of someone, yeah, I didn't mind that because I felt like I was in control. I was the one sort of deciding to go to that bar, which I knew was a safe place. I knew the bartender. Oh, my God, I was
But the attention didn't have a degrading quality to it.
No, not at all.
What were there moments when there was a degrading quality to it or something that felt, I don't know, aggressive?
I think most women have experienced that. And again, I think there's a piece of it. I remember I was once in New York on a business trip, and I would stay at the Hilton in Midtown. And there was this adorable Irish bartender, and I love an accent. I can't do accents, but he was just adorable. And there was a guy really bugging me. And I said something to the guy, like, you know what, I'm just having a drink here. I'm just happy to be on my own. And he was just obnoxious. And I remember like turning to him and I saying, no, you don't get it. There's nothing you're going to say right now that's going to, don't buy me a drink. Don't, this is just my space. And then as it turns out, Liam, hello, Liam. Oh, that's British. That's not Irish. Liam, this gorgeous bartender, this young guy came to, you know, stand up and said, listen, you know, don't leave her alone. And then I ended up having this very romantic, like, sudden fling with Liam, the young bartender. So, yes, I don't know if I answered any of your questions, but I wanted to say about safety. You know, I do think there is, every woman I know, any age, if I'm in San Francisco, which is a lovely place, but I live in the city, if I am walking from, we have a garage like a block from our house, if I'm walking to our apartment from our garage, I have my keys out. I mean, I still feel like it's 1980 and I'm taking back the night because there was, you know, so much rape and just scary stuff for women. And I always have the fear, and most women I know don't feel particularly safe in their own bodies, their own skin when they're out. Now, in San Francisco, in the neighborhoods I walk around, I do.
You mentioned, you know, you said taking back the night. You made it sound as if that problem is not there anymore. Are you talking about San Francisco specifically, where it was more dangerous back then?
I went to school in Ann Arbor in Michigan. Hail to the victors, all that stuff. And in Ann Arbor, I think there was a, at that time, there was a serial rapist. There was something happening that the community of young women, you know, were, what are we, 20 at the time, felt incredibly unsafe. And we were told, don't walk alone, always with have someone. It's like, are you kidding me? And that, so there was a, you know, there were a series of marches that I think were in D.C., might have been nationwide, I don't know, that were, you know, take back the night, take back your power. You are allowed to be able to walk somewhere by yourself.
Yeah, and so many of the colleges would only give instructions to women about how to change this.
That is so true.
And I think a lot of people, and I suppose myself included, that didn't really strike me as odd because I'd never really stopped to think about what it might be like to be in the shoes of someone who feared for their safety going from their dorm to the study hall.
Oh, we had an escort service. You know, U of M student services thought it was a great idea, and it was. I mean, it was a solution that if you were at the undergraduate, you were the ugly, the library, and you had to go back to Markley to go to your dorm, and it's, I don't know, a half mile away, you could call for an escort service. So campus police or whoever the volunteers were would come and walk you there. And it was a solution, but it does, it just does sting of.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that that shouldn't be done, but it's like, why isn't there also education for men? And, you know, it sounds kind of ridiculous on the surface saying, oh, so you're going to try to educate somebody who's committed to being a rapist.
Right.
But I think one of the benefits of talking about that is so that the men who aren't rapists can maybe be a better ally, to have more compassion, to understand, to even just kind of have it sink in on some level.
Paul, last night when I was still in San Francisco, before I, or whatever, 2 days ago when I was in San Francisco, I was walking from, I always figure out like where to park that's closest to my house. If I don't park in the garage, if I can get a space closer so I don't have to walk that block, I do. And I was walking, you know, literally five doors, and a young guy, he was just a dude. He had a backpack, and he was walking behind me, and I know the women out there can relate to me. And I turned around, because I'm always checking, who are you? Mm-hmm. Are you, do you look at all threatening? I always, when I'm walking around San Francisco, or maybe I am crazy, and maybe no one relates to this, I wait if I can. I do that ballroom dancing. I think before the podcast we were talking about, I do ballroom dancing, which is great, but it's about a mile from my house. And occasionally I'll just want to walk back. So I get out. It's 9 p.m. San Francisco. I walk very intentionally. I keep my eyes out for couples that I can walk near. If anyone is at all threatening, I go into the bus lane where I know like city buses walk by. And maybe it's just me and I feel more vulnerable than I should. But, you know, what is that? Shooting all over yourself, right?
I've never heard that, that phrase.
But the fact is, I do feel really vulnerable. And that's kind of a shame. I also, I want to say sometimes I feel strong like ox. So there's that.
Do you, when you're experiencing those moments of invisibility, is it, are there ever times where it's coupled with maybe a woman who, I don't know what the word would be, is kind of intellectually vacant and getting all the attention?
Well, that's interesting. That is interesting. You know, I can't think of one, but I probably will. But when you said that, I had not connected this until literally just now. My mom, who we may or may not end up talking about her, she was she lived in Germany until she was eight, lived in the time of World War II and the Holocaust and all that. And she, her family, she was an immigrant to this country when she was eight or nine. And
she fled Nazi Germany?
Yeah. And I mean,
I never knew that about you.
Yeah. Oh, there's a ton of trauma for her. I mean, I think it's interesting, the intergenerational trauma that my sisters
and, it doesn't stick with the, the survivor. In fact, we did an episode on that about, I don't know, maybe 8 years ago, intergenerational Holocaust trauma.
Yeah.
But go ahead.
And so she, two things about my mom, and she was phenomenal. I mean, magnificent woman, strong and loyal, and defended her daughters, her family, her granddaughters like nobody's business. I'm amazed that she ever died because she was just like woman of steel. But the fact is that covered, her strength was a cover for the deep depression she suffered her whole life, which she never really got help for. I think she went to therapy literally one session with some dude, who knows who it was. She suffered from deep depression that I think my sisters and I both believe was trauma related. You know, because she was in Germany, her dad spent, it's a little unclear from the documentation, but he spent some amount of time, 6 months to 8 months in Dachau, and escaped. It was before they did the numbering system. This was early in the Nazi reign. He did not have a number. But my mom's sister and her mom left Germany under cover of night, went from Germany to Italy to England, and had a sponsor. You needed a sponsor back then. Some incredibly distant relative in New York, Ilma Kearns, who sponsored them, and they came to the United States. But she was eight. I have a granddaughter who is five, who seems fully formed, like an amazing little person to me. My mom was 3 years older than Audrey is. And to think that an eight-year-old left her country, did not know English, had to learn English coming over, traumatized, did not know where her dad was. And is one of the stories she used to tell is when she, I think when she came to the United States, she didn't know a lot of English. There was a boy in her class. She had German, long German pigtails, which is how they wore their hair. And the boy in back of her used to take her pigtails and dunk them in the inkwells of their desk. So one day, in a very Ruth way, she was little, she just cut her pigtails off. Like, nope, that's not going to happen to me. I'm not going to be a victim. Her mom, when I guess in the last year they were there in 1939-ish, all the Jews she grew up in a town called Steinsfurt, tiny little town in Germany near, the biggest city was in Mannheim. And I'm bastardizing the name because I'm bad with accents, but there was a Jewish school. She had to take an hour train ride by herself at age five to go to the German school that was for Jews. And my grandma, to an hour on a train by yourself at five. So my grandma would bribe, they only got a few eggs and a few rations of milk and meat. My grandma would bribe the conductor with eggs to look over little Ruth, my mom. I mean, you know, it's just you do what you need to do. Yeah. The other weird thing, I had a friend at Stanford who suffered from depression
a lot.
And
what did you do at Stanford?
Ah, yes. I worked there for 25 years. I mean, so grateful.
Are you retired now?
I am. I do coaching full time now.
Right.
I do.
And that I knew, but I didn't know what the Stanford.
Yeah.
What did you do there?
I ran one of their alumni relations departments, and we put on massive events. We would do reunions. I mean, we'd have 13,000 people on campus for 4 days and do all kinds of stuff, and it was endless events and volunteer stewardship. And in the end, I managed a team. So I was the director of this one department. And what I realized is, although the events were very satisfying and exhausting, what my favorite thing was always when someone from my team would look troubled, down, fragile, and I would have a one-on-one with them. And then we'd talk about what was really happening in their lives. It wasn't always about work. It was about their marriage. It was about their kids. And that's when I thought, what I really want to do, I loved managing a team, and events were great. In 25 years, I did it. But then I went down the being trained to be a coach, which, you know, I took whatever it was, 3 years of classes at, I think in, it's called the Coaches Training Institute, CTI, outside of San Francisco.
Which is life coaching, correct?
Life coaching. Oh, and what a terrible name for it. I mean, it sounds, you know, the minute you say life coaching, the eyes roll, people are like, oh, God. Paul, it is so friggin' amazing. Two things about coaching that are true. They always say you'll fall in love with your clients, and you do.
But you don't mean romantically.
No, but you just have such empathy for what they're experiencing. And, you know, I firmly believe that you walk down any street, anyone you see, anyone you bump into, everyone's dealing with something. Mm-hmm. Physical, mental, you know, emotional, relationship-y, family. And so when people come to me, most of it's by word of mouth. It's amazing to understand their story, where they are. And the big thing about coaching is there's a great analogy I use. People ask me, what's the difference between therapy, consulting, and coaching? And I think I came up with this, but if somewhere out there in listener land you came up with it, let me know and I will give you all the credit. If you were an adult person and you wanted to learn how to ride a bike, here's the breakdown. So a therapist might talk to you about why you never learned to ride a bike as a kid and how sad that made you. Maybe you were deemed the unathletic one, or your parents didn't have enough money to buy you a bike, so that was not an option for you, and how sad and hurt you are. That might not get you riding a bike, but at least you've worked through some of it. But again, you're not riding the bike yet. A consultant would probably print out everything about riding bikes, get you all the manuals. They might even buy you a huge, expensive bike and give you all the information you need and make you feel really good about the potential. But, you know, by the end of the day, you leave the consultant, they charge you a lot of money, and you still aren't riding a bike. So the idea of a coach is I hear 10 minutes of the past. I get, you know, 10 minutes of, oh, do you have a bike? Kind of a little bit of what the consultant gets. But then a coach puts you on the fucking bike. And I'm riding alongside you saying, okay, yeah, your balance is good. Oh, you're leaning to the left. Oh, eyes up. Watch that pothole. And I'm running alongside you. Run until you're steady. You're going towards your future. And I let go. And I'm done.
I love that analogy.
I'm out. The goal of every coach should be not to be your coach anymore. Give you the tools.
Yeah. Well, I am so glad you made the trip down here to talk about these things. And it's so great seeing you every Sunday in the waiting room. You're such a big and important and compassionate part of that. And I just I appreciate you.
I do too, but I'm not going to let this go because I fucked up. Here I'm swearing. I'm such a potty mouth. It's so nice to be able to swear. At work, I could never swear. I was always like, don't swear. Paul, I was going to start this out with something that I think you are going to be tempted to cut. Please don't cut it.
Okay.
Manny Moe, if you're listening, don't let Paul cut this. I I've listened to you since the very first episode, on and off, on and off, multiple times, 3, 4. You are phenomenal. What you do, how you talk to people. I've experienced it now. So in some ways, I'm glad I'm saying this later. You are empathetic. You're deep. You know, you are a deep cat. And you have such an ability. I see this in the group a lot, to bring people out, to understand how the group dynamic is. And for some people, it's beyond, I go to you for comfort and for validation that, wow, the world's complicated and all the stuff you bring to light. But I know some people, you know, have gone to you in very dark moments where you are their lifeline. You are the voice. Someone said the other day, just your voice is such a bit of heaven, like a pillow. We can go in and feel reassured. So I want to thank you on behalf of all the people who are nodding their heads and saying, yeah, that Paul guy, he is just, I mean, it's very fangirl of me. And I don't fucking care, because you are phenomenal.
It doesn't feel that way. And I'm actually comfortable taking that in. Over the 12 years of doing this, at first it was like, oh, I better make fun here. Mm. People are going to, if I don't interject something, people are going to think I'm full of myself. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I'm getting better at not thinking that it's a bad thing to just let somebody love on me.
Love on you.
Yeah.
And so we're ending this. So I wanted to end it with some great thing, because sometimes people, it's like, oh, it's over. And I was going to try to memorize, you know, may the sun always be shining, the wind at your back. But I think I will end it the way I end most things. You look like you're hungry. Go eat something.
Oh, my God. You are Jewish.
I'm Jewish. Yes. Indeed. Thanks,
Thank
Paul.
You, Leslie.
What a sweet soul. And really love talking to her. And I can't believe that we've done the podcast for 12 years, and that's the first time that we've done an episode about an older woman feeling invisible. Very grateful to her. Let's see if we have an ad.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure, with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This is from the Shame and Secret Survey, and this is filled out by a woman who calls herself Mom, Wife, Liar. She identifies as straight. She's in her 30s, says that she was raised in a stable and safe environment, never been sexually abused, never been physically or emotionally abused. Darkest thoughts. I'm a burden on my family. I do not add anything positive to my family. I am broken inside in a way that can't be fixed. There's something fundamentally wrong with me. Despite shame from my bad choices and behavior, I continue. How can I live with myself? Darkest secrets. I never graduated college. My entire family believes I did. But I found out I was credit short to the required amount. Everyone had already congratulated me, planned a party, sent me cards. I couldn't bear to face the shame. I couldn't speak the words out loud. It was like my skin was on fire from the inside out, from the guilt. It haunts me to this day. You know, some questions that pop into my mind, or observations. Number one is, you're really, really hard on yourself. And number two is, it might be worth exploring why it is that you feel that you can't share this with your family. Are they shaming? Is there conditional love rather than unconditional love? Because, you know, not graduating college and pretending you did is, you know, it's not the end of the world. And it's not like, you know, you killed someone. I think people hearing me read this survey feel for you. Like, my God, you are just so hard on yourself. Sexual fantasies most powerful to you, rape and rough. What, if anything, would you like to say to someone you haven't been able to? I wish I could tell my partner the truth. What, if anything, do you wish for? I wish I could go back in time to when I should have made a better choice and correct it. I bet that's a common one, but I wonder what my life would have been like if I was a better, less selfish, more responsible person. You are so, so hard on yourself, so shaming. And I wonder where that voice came from. Have you shared these things with others? No, I wanted to, but it was physically painful. And then days, months, years passed, and it was too big. How do you feel after writing these things down? Glad I told someone. I feel sad and ashamed. Is there anything you'd like to share with someone who shares your thoughts or experiences? I'm sorry you are experiencing this too. Thank you for sharing that. And that breaks my heart. That breaks my heart. This is from the Love Survey filled out by Emu. And they write, I love the smell of pine trees. I live in Australia, and so the only time I smell it is around Christmas when people are selling Christmas trees. It reminds me of the summer when I was 11 years old, when I felt like I was happy before the high school, which was terrible. It was the only year my family ever had a real pine tree, and it brings back such happy memories. But it's such a hard scent to come by here. It's something special to me. I love that one. Yeah, there is. Even though I'm not a big fan of Christmas, I do love the smell of Christmas trees. This is from the Shame and Secret Survey, and this is filled out by a woman who calls herself Mrs. K. She identifies as straight. She's in her 30s. She says that she was raised in a totally chaotic environment. She was the victim of sexual abuse and never reported it. She writes, I was molested around age 9 by an older girl in my apartment complex. I never told my mom. I don't remember feeling shame, but do remember feeling fear. I was sexually assaulted in my teens after smoking entirely too much pot. I woke up in his bed and he was on top of me. All of my clothes were on and he was dry humping me. I don't really know now if I didn't have the capacity to wake up enough to try and stop him, or if I was pretending to be passed out so he didn't get violent. I was raped when I was 23 by my best friend's husband. I went to the hospital for a rape kit, but ended up not going through with it. I'm not sure how I feel about any of it. She's been emotionally abused. Between my biological father and an ex-husband, the following methods were used to emotionally abuse: verbal attacks, gaslighting, control and manipulation, isolation, threats and intimidation, emotional neglect, invalidating emotions. As far as being physically abused, I'm still not certain if I have an actual memory of my bio father being physical with me or if I made it up. My ex-husband would poke me in the sternum and get up in my face in a threatening way, but nobody's ever punched or kicked or hit me outright. And, you know, to which I would say it, you know, physical abuse can be the threat of being physical with someone, because our central nervous system, I don't know, there's not a big difference between being physically assaulted and, you know, being sure that we are about to be physically assaulted or not knowing if that is going to come true or not. Any positive experiences with abusers? Sure, there were positive experiences. No, it does not complicate my feelings, but I'm well away from that time in life. Probably back then, it did complicate things. Darkest thoughts? I can't think of any. darkest secrets? I can't think of any. Sexual fantasy is most powerful to you. My only sexual fantasy is one where I either feel 100% connected to the person or 0% connected to the person. Anywhere in between feels forced. Thank you for filling that, all of that out. And I'm so sorry that you experienced so many horrible things as a kid and as a adolescent and as a grown woman. I appreciate you going back deep down into the icky to talk about it. This is from the What Has Helped You survey, and this is filled out by a woman who calls herself Winnie the Pooh. And what are your issues or struggles? Sadness and anxious feelings, binge eating, skin picking. I am not diagnosed with any mental illnesses. What has helped you deal with them? Taoism and meditation. And then 4 exclamation points. Taoism is a Chinese philosophy which was created by Lao Tzu, which talks about accepting things, understanding that nothing is perfect, that balance is important, nature and the seasons are important. People shouldn't have desires, but instead be flexible. Desires lead to disappointment, so just do what is most natural. Go with the flow and don't force things. It's helped me so much with overcoming my black and white thinking. Meditation also helps a lot with this. I meditate 30 minutes each day. I think black and white thinking is really my biggest struggle because it makes me think either it's all over and I should completely give up, or it's all amazing from now on and will never not be amazing, which of course sets me up for disappointment. I love it. I love it. Yeah, black and white thinking. It's a motherfucker. And amazing. This is from the Shame and Secret survey, and this is filled out by a guy who calls him Phoenix, and then it's 3 X's at the end of his name. He is in his 30s. He identifies sexually as other. He wrote, "I am open to anything and everything." He says that he was raised in a slightly dysfunctional environment. I've ever been the victim of sexual abuse. Some stuff happened, but I don't know if it counts. He doesn't elaborate. He says that he has never been emotionally abused. He's not sure if he's been physically abused. Any positive experiences with abusers? I don't know if it was classified as abuse. Then I didn't realize it because I started to like it. Darkest thoughts. And by the way, those are 2 separate things. You know, our body can feel pleasure while our soul is recoiling or feeling overwhelmed by something. You know, I think that's one of the things that people who have never experienced that don't understand, is that, you know, part I think people who have never experienced sexual abuse tend to think that it's, you know, about body parts and physical pain or being, you know, restrained. And sometimes it can just be, it's too intense, you know, and that person was, even if they were feeling sexual pleasure, it just kind of overwhelmed their central nervous system. Darkest thoughts. I'm embarrassed and ashamed to admit that I've often thought about what it would feel like to be chained to a bench or tree in town naked and experimented on. Darkest secrets. My biggest secret is that I lost my virginity and was taught and shown what to do by my older sister, and I always do as I'm told when told to, or she wouldn't teach me anymore. Sexual fantasies most powerful to you. I want to experience everything and try everything at least once, but I get scared to say anything unless it's to my sister. What, if anything, would you like to say to someone you haven't been able to? Nothing specific. What, if anything, do you wish for? Someone who is willing to take control. Have you shared these things with others? Not directly, mainly because I'm scared I will ruin everything. How do you feel after writing these things down? A lot happier. Is there anything you'd like to share with someone who shares your thoughts or experiences? I don't know of anyone who does. Man. Thank you for filling that out. And if you're listening, I really, really want to encourage you to find someone to open up to, you know, preferably a mental health professional or a support group, because it sounds like you're struggling. It sounds like you're struggling, and I don't mean we have no control over what our sexual fantasies are, what turns us on, but we do have control over how we choose to express them in ways that, you know, hopefully are respectful to ourselves and to others and don't erode the quality of our life or the life of someone else. This is from the What Has Helped You survey, and this is filled out by a woman who calls herself Stephanie. What are your struggles? Needing to laugh more. What's helped you deal with them? Not taking things so seriously. What, if anything, have people said or done that's helped you with your issues? And she writes, those Bachelor shows. I imagine the moments that aren't on TV, like when each evening of drinking and icky flirting is done, the production staff brings in a wheelbarrow and drunk people climb in, or they are gently picked up off the floor and placed into the wheelbarrow and taken to a detox room. I can't watch those Bachelor shows in their entirety, but I imagine they all drink a lot of booze. Then I tell my loved ones about my thoughts and we all laugh. Thank you for that. I got to say, that is the first time I've had that one, but I am definitely a fan of taking ourselves less seriously, man. It's, that is something I definitely, definitely struggle with. This is from the Shame and Secret survey, and this is filled out by a woman who calls herself Alice likes cake. She identifies as bisexual. She's in her 30s, says that she was raised in a pretty dysfunctional environment. Ever been the victim of sexual abuse? Yes, and I never reported it. And also some stuff happened, but I don't know if it counts. She writes, when I was 13, my best friend's 40-year-old uncle got us blackout drunk and came on to me. I remember his hand on my thigh between my legs, then remember being in his bed. Then his girlfriend came home and tried to beat me up. I ran away and cried. So fucked up that you were the one that she beat up. My best friend made me promise never to tell. After that, I blackout drank regularly. I was sexually assaulted a year later by two 17-year-old boys at the same time. I was too drunk to consent. When I told my parents about both these incidents, the friend's uncle and the boys, they said it was my fault because I was drunk. Wow. Wow. Today I listened to your show and realize I experienced covert incest and many physical/verbal boundary violations by my father. I have also been forced to have sex in a long-term relationship. She's been physically abused and emotionally abused. My brother frequently physically and verbally assaulted me throughout my childhood. My parents did nothing. My first physically abusive relationship was age 16 to 18. I lived with him. He also cheated on me. My first marriage was emotionally abusive. He was a narcissist and a drug addict. My second and current marriage, although better than the first, is emotionally abusive. There has been infidelity. I'm thinking about leaving. I think about it all the time. Any positive experiences with abusers? Definitely. I'm realizing I'm addicted to validation from men, and I felt painfully in love with and addicted to male partners in spite of their treatment of me. I recommend this book all the time, but if you're listening, I think it would be worth checking out the book, Facing a Love Addiction by Pia Melody. Darkest thoughts. I think about my husband dying and running away from my life. Darkest secrets. I was very hypersexual as a child. I feel a lot of shame about things I did. I've struggled with addiction, and my daughters, 11 and 18, have been affected by all my choices. I feel immense regret for many of my choices. Sexual fantasies most powerful to you. This is terrible and fucked up. I fantasize about being a child and a willing participant in sexual activity with adults, or my husband having an affair with an underage girl. I'm very ashamed of these thoughts. You do not choose to have those feelings inside you. What, if anything, would you like to say to someone you haven't been able to? I would like to tell my daughters I'm sorry for all the mistakes I've made as a mom, but I never want them to feel responsible for my feelings, so hopefully I can just make it up to them and break the cycle in our lives. I would really encourage you, if you're not in therapy currently, a little later down she talks about my therapist. What, if anything, you wish for? I wish I loved myself and felt I deserved to feel good and be loved. Isn't it interesting how we can know that intellectually, but we can't get there emotionally? Have you shared these things with others? Some things, yes. Even with my therapist, I hold back because I'm afraid of how she will see me. I was raised in a house where outward appearances were the most important and things were hidden slash not discussed. How do you feel after writing these things down? Pretty ashamed, actually, but also sorry for my child self. Is there anything you'd like to share with someone who shares your thoughts or experiences? Not everything is your fault. You don't deserve to suffer and be abused. You have inherent value no matter your choices and mistakes. Isn't it amazing how we can be spot on about talking to someone else, and yet we can't talk that way to ourselves? It never ceases to amaze me. Sending you some love. And then finally, this is from the Loves survey, speaking of loves. And this is filled out by, I don't have the name on it. But they write, I love water, being in it or near it. I love the ocean. I remember going on beach holidays as a kid with my family. I live in South Africa, and my British mom always insisted we take holidays, even when my parents were pressed financially. We would always camp at this beautiful place in the Eastern Cape. Super cheap, super quiet, sand dunes, rock pools, empty beaches. Anyway, in those times, when I thought I was straight and had not had any romantic experiences beyond those with girlfriends that I fooled myself about, I would stop sometimes mid-walk on the beach and breathe it all in. I'd feel the wind and taste the salt of the ocean and think very intensely about whoever I currently had a crush on. In parentheses, this imagination of mine was highly accomplished and included a deeply besotted writing practice. The writing of it all would just hit me so hard and all over as I stood there staring at the waves. Now that I'm older and have had a few real-life love sagas, I've learned that this intense feeling of heavy-hitting romance is a place that's internal to me. And mindfulness has taught me that if it doesn't even require narrative, that it doesn't even require narrative or reason. Real-life love is wonderful but different. Relational energy, reciprocity, water love is simple, ancient, and perfect. I love rain. I live in Johannesburg, and here we get the most amazing summer thunderstorms. They can be kind of frightening, with hectic lightning and very loud thunder, but it's a warm thrill, especially from the daybed in my lounge, which is my favorite place to be in a storm. I switch off the lights, open a window, and get under the blanket to watch the curtains billowing dramatically and feel stray drops spraying inside until the window decision is no longer viable. If I'm having a terrible day and it starts to rain, I almost always hear myself whispering, "Thank you," and then retroactively often realize what a tough time I was giving myself. It's all quite cute. How does rain make things suddenly less consequential? I would love to be more like rain. And I love to swim. As I mentioned, I grew up in Johannesburg, a not too fancy suburban area. We had moved from the UK when I was 3, a mixed race family of 7, just a year after democracy in South Africa, in parentheses, those stories for another time. And my mom sent me to this teenage girl swimming teacher's house, let's call her Kay, to learn to swim. Kay was about 16 at that time. And I think of her more and more often now because she was such a wonderful force in my life. She taught me to dive and swim in the pool in her garden, and I loved it. I loved it. I loved it. Then graduated to the 25-meter free public swimming pool just around the corner from our house. Aside from school, the public pool was the main second location of mine and my siblings' upbringing. Kay, the swimming teacher, who had very entrepreneurially set up her own small business, took us for lessons and training along with other kids in the neighborhood for years. I was there all the time between about ages 4 and 13, and it is truly one of the things in life I am most grateful for. My introduction to water, in this way, is classically urban, very Joburg. Chlorine, concrete, laps, but water did its thing, and water does its thing, regardless of Joburg's cosmopolitan ugliness or any other place. It has been through explorations of water's otherness, where the body is no longer subject to physical realities or burdens of air and earth's life, that have been rescued in adult life over and over again. That we are mostly made of water means this makes deep sense. There's home in water. I think we are all called by it. Damn. Damn. That was poetic. If you are not a writer, get on it. Because that was some good shit. If you are out there and you are feeling stuck, there's help. There is help. Our tribe is out there. It's just a matter of finding it. Does this get repetitive the way I close the show? I don't know. I don't care. I'm glad I reached out for help 20 plus years ago. I'm glad I stuck around, even though I was convinced I shouldn't, because I've gotten to experience so many amazing things. And so many awful things that I didn't think I was going to get through, and I managed to get through and found little silver linings on the other side of them. But if you're out there and you're feeling stuck, just never forget that you are not alone. And thanks for listening.
Everybody I know is bizarrely beautifully
Everybody
fucked up
I know
in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully
Everybody
fucked up in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully
Everybody
fucked up in some weird way.